professor of the practice of religion in public life at the Harvard Kennedy School, a little school across the river. He's also Secretary of Health and Social Services at the Archdiocese of Boston. He's a recipient of the MacArthur so-called Genius Grant and of 25 honorary degrees. 25, I can't even count that high. When I reached out to Brian Hare today to ask if he might join us, it was before the most recent round of the Catholic Church sexual abuse crisis, as that might be something of an elephant in this room right now. Let's begin by addressing that straight on. And I should say, make a note that with us today, as he is most summer Sundays, is Richard Gilman. Richard, would you raise your hand back there? Richard Gilman, who from 1999 to 2006 was the publisher of the Boston Globe. He oversaw the spotlight team that uncovered the abuse. So earlier this week, I reached out to Father Hare to offering him a chance to not be here today, saying that it felt like I was inviting him as a sheep to the slaughter in this old Protestant church, and suggesting that if he felt uneasy about being here, it was just fine. Nobody would ever know that we'd even had the conversation. Reverend Hare, will you tell Old South Church what you said to me?
Well, I said, I said to you, this is my life. Yeah. I don't go anywhere without having to address this. But I also would never have turned down this gracious invitation. I'm a New Englander by birth and background, although I spent a large part of my life in Washington. And my New England roots means that this place, this church, this history, and this ministry that you carry out is something I deeply treasure as a citizen of this city, a citizen of this state. So I thank you for the gracious invitation to come and be here. What I would say is what I say to my own congregation. The sexual abuse crisis, meaning the sexual abuse of children by priests of the Roman Catholic Church, is three things. It is a sin. In Catholic terms, we call it mortal sin. It is a crime. Not every sin is a crime, but this is both a sin and a crime. And it has been a massive failure of episcopal oversight by those who have ultimate responsibility for the care of people in their care. And so we need to begin with that. The second thing I say to my own congregation and those to whom I speak is that the fault is all on this side of the pulpit. The whole church did not fail. Priests failed. Bishops failed. The whole church did not fail. So we hear a lot of conversation today about the need for conversion and penance. That lies upon what Cardinal O'Malley himself said was the failure of priests and bishops. And so that's my definition of what it is. When somebody asks me from my community, what resources do we have to deal with this? I draw three from the New Testament and from the hymn we just sang. The three resources we have are faith, reason, and hope. Those three are grounded in what we believe, and we need to use each of them. God works through the human, but God will not do our work for us. So we have to rely on faith, we have to use our best reason, and we have to keep alive hope, which is the capacity to deal with reality and not be overwhelmed. And now we are dealing with an awful reality which could easily overwhelm us. But we cannot fail. Both because of our role in the society, we've got to be good citizens, and in the preservation of the faith that we believe.
Thank you. They say that the most In his Mass, Bernstein is Job, is Abraham, is Jacob, is railing at and wrestling with and arguing with God. He questions whether the Church's liturgical life, its rites and its rituals, has any meaning anymore, any relevance in contemporary life, in public life. He asks if the Church's rites and rituals don't ring hollow. Reverend Hare, you bridge the worlds of academia and church and politics like few others. So may I ask you this? Today, what good is the Church to the United States of America, to the adventure and experiment of democracy?
In one sense, I'd like to say it is the good that it has always been. For we believe as a church that we are rooted in a larger truth, even than the truths that we honor are in our political and social traditions. So I believe in the first instance, the Church must keep alive what it believes. Even if the community shrinks, we need to hold to the truth as Paul held to the truth in good and bad times. We need to remember that Paul himself complained to God about his weakness and said, "Take away from me this sense of weakness." God said, "I will not do it, because in your weakness you will find my power." So the first thing the Church must do is hold on to what it believes. The second thing it must do, it seems to me, is in a society that depends upon civil institutions, nonprofit institutions, to do the work of feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, sheltering the homeless. The pattern of that service that goes on in this country, if it collapses, the country will be in worse shape than it is in. Now, there is no question when the Church itself sins, as I have said, it makes it twice as hard to do your work, twice as hard to make the contribution you can. But if the first thing we offer the country is the truth we believe, try to live by it, share it, share the capacity for hope, even in secular terms. The second thing is the structure of our institutions. They are part of the fabric of this country. And if they go away, we'll be in worse shape than we're in. Do our institutions rise to what is needed? For various reasons, I think we don't, but we have the capacity to do so. And finally, we're in this awful problem that we can't even be civil. We can't even find a way not just to agree with each other, but even to talk to each other. Civility is charity in secular terms. And so keeping alive communities that can disagree about politics, disagree about economics, but be civil, hopefully that can spread out a bit into the wider society. But we must do it ourselves before we can share it.
You and I are both old enough to remember when the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestant churches in Boston were turned to regularly for spiritual and ethical authority. And that just isn't the case anymore, in part due to the Spotlight Team. But no other institution has taken the Church's place. I think there's an ethical and moral vacuum out there. Can we, here's my question, can we, should we endeavor to regain our moral authority? Is it gone forever, if not the Church? Who?
Again, I would speak from my conviction. I don't think the Church is destined to disappear. I say that from a conviction of faith rather than empirical analysis in the first instance. But faith, as the hymn said, combined with reason. And and faith undergirds reason. So I say with some conviction, the church, whatever the community, the ecclesial community is, however different it is from the days when all of our churches in this city were packed, when every citizen was almost universally Christian and American. In a very different day, a richer day in a sense, because of the making. In my community, you didn't say where you lived in Boston, you said what parish you belonged to. It was the identity question. But I don't think the church will disappear. I do think we all live at moments that we don't define. We all inherit a present that we don't control. And therefore, I think always it's part of the church's role to ask, what is this moment? Where do the threats come from? Where do the possibilities exist? And where are the resources, ancient and contemporary, that can help us to build? So there's more than one source of moral authority. Your point about the Spotlight Kingdom and the Globe, we should be grateful for an investigative press. Cardinal O'Malley has said, without it, we wouldn't have found out what we didn't know. We should be grateful that we live in a democracy where every person can come. Right now, we're in an intersection of both weakness of civil institutions and weakness of religion. If you say, if not the church, what? I would rather frame it differently and say, there are multiple sources of moral authority, among whom the religious community should be one, but we share the stage, and we've got to find a way to make our contribution. But moral authority goes beyond religious authority. And once again, faith and reason go together.
You have argued that religion will always be with us. Humans are wired to be religious, that education and enlightenment and secularization, as much as they maybe would like to exercise our religious inclinations, can't do that. Religion is a potent thing. Like a surgeon's knife, it can be used for good or for ill, to heal or to harm. And we think about the harming, the sexual abuse, violence, terror, the 9/11 anniversary we're just remembering. You claim that religion has the potential to contribute positively to a world that knows too much violence, too much poverty, and too many human rights violations. Can you be specific about that?
Well, as I look at those questions, and I really teach secular subjects for the most part. Indeed, a vast amount of my teaching over the years has been with the military, talking about limits on the use of force. And actually, in our time, there's a resurgence of a debate about moral argument and military argument, a very serious discussion. For over 25 years, I've gone to the National War College and watched people struggle with questions, with mistakes they've made, with challenges they face. So there's a certain way in which there is a return to asking questions that emerge out of the religious framework. But if you ask, what's the church's capacity to deal with violence, poverty, climate change, what's the church's capacity? Again, for me, it's a mix of three things: substance, structure, and community. So we do possess substantive truths that not everyone holds, and we should acknowledge that and beware of it. But if we believe they are substantive truths with lasting importance, the sacredness of the human person, the social nature of the human person, we cannot be fully fulfilled as individuals if we are not part of a social fabric. That cuts against the grain of much of what we hear life today, where at times it seems like it's Hobbesian in its beginning, Hobbesian in its loyalty. We cannot let the world simply believe a Hobbesian future is the only future. So substantive truths we need to keep alive, develop them, engage them. It's one thing to say you believe that the ancient doctrine of limits on war, just war, is one thing. It's another thing to relate it to nuclear weapons and cyber. That has not been done for us. We've got to do it. It's one thing to look at globalization as a force that has produced wealth in an unknown way in aggregate terms. But globalization has its own logic. It doesn't have its own ethic. There is no sense of limits. There is no sense that you measure it ultimately. No sense, at least for some, that you measure it ultimately, not by its aggregate productive capability, but by its impact on human life. Substantive truth, structure. Structure in this country and structure across country. We are increasingly secular. The world is not increasingly secular. In places where some of the greatest suffering that goes on in the world today, religion is what people hold on to because there's no other fabric to hold on. And so as we try to make this country relevant to this kind of world, the structure that is transnational in religion, I always say transnational actors have the following characteristics. They're based in one place, present in several places, have a trained core of personnel, a single guiding philosophy, and a sophisticated communication system. That's IBM, the World Bank, and the Jesuits. And so, and that's the truth. There are various organizations with the capacity to link up across boundary lines. We're not hearing much about that in our public life either. It's about us and our identity and our interests. There's nothing wrong with interests as long as we understand there's a larger interest we've got to relate to. So substance, structure, and then community. Religious believers are citizens wherever they are. And so how deeply they believe, how creatively they use the truth we have, and how fulsomely they support the structures that feed and clothe and house. Those are things we take for granted almost in religious institutions, but we need to step it up in the face of what we are challenged by today.
Thank you. Leonard Bernstein could have ended his mass on a negative note. In fact, another Jesuit priest and activist, Daniel Berrigan, some of you will know him, suggested that he end Mass in a militant mood, and I quote Berrigan, "Yell at them and turn off the lights." That was Berrigan's suggestion. But Bernstein chose otherwise. At the end, a solo flute and a boy soprano reintroduce simple song from the opening. And the company gradually are awakened to a new hope. One by one, they are raised, resurrected, in peace and praise. Mass concludes with simple faith and the much longed for peace. Father Hare, do you have a final word for us on the efficacy of a simple faith?
Do you always ask these kind of questions? I'll have to take a big answer. Simple faith. Well, in a certain way, the faith is simple. At its beginning, it is simple. Scriptures tell us, be still and know that I am God. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, take your shoes off and don't come too close, for I am different from you all. To believe that there's a reality that is that large, that surrounds us in the world, brings one to simplicity of adoration, simplicity of silence, simplicity of awe and wonder. But it can't stay there, nor did it in the Christian faith. So you start with four Gospels, and then the next thing you know, you have the doctors of the church. You have Augustine spreading out volumes from those four Gospels. And that's because it's faith and reason. It's faith that keeps things simple, direct, illuminates mystery. Religious mystery does not mean something unintelligible. It means something infinitely intelligible. So that we can probe religious mystery for the ages and be taught anew. So faith starts with simplicity, but it moves to complexity. Sometimes the move is not fruitful. We call it heresy. We call it misguided religion. But the simplicity draws us back, and it must grow because the world changes around us. Augustine knew nothing of nuclear weapons or of globalization. And so it is a matter of starting with stark simplicity. Be still and know that I am God. And then it moves out from that to how does this truth relate to the world of our time, our place, our time of race, poverty, discrimination, war, lack of civility. There are multiple challenges. But the faith must become complex in both the way it is lived, understood, and in the institutions it presents, because stark simplicity by itself can leave us isolated, enhanced by the vision we hold, but offering nothing to the wider world.